Welcome back, everyone. This is Ryan Selkis. You're listening to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I discuss key industry trends with crypto's top investors, builders, and thinkers. Just a reminder, Messari is much more than a podcast company. So if you're an industry professional or crypto investor, head over to Messari.io and check out Messari Pro, our crypto toolkit that offers best-in-class research, advanced screening, and charting tools to keep you ahead of the investing curve, plus a new enterprise alerts tool. We're also hosting the industry's largest virtual event, the Mainnet, this June 1st through 3rd, with over 50 hours of programming, 100 confirmed speakers, and virtual networking that's so seamless, you'll feel like you're actually there. 50% of the profits are heading to COVID relief, so go reserve your spot today at mainnet.events. That's Messari.io for pro research and tools, and mainnet.events for the best virtual event you'll attend this year. With that, strap in for another episode. Going to be a good one. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESSARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app from merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today. This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, welcome back to the Citadel. It's Messari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2BitIdiot on Twitter. And thank you for tuning in to another very special program. We've got Paolo Arduino, the CTO of Bitfinex. We've got a fascinating conversation ahead of us. We've already done a bit of a pre-brief, and spoiler alert, we're going to try to avoid legal issues and some of the murkier areas of international crypto finance for good reason, but there is a ton to talk about in terms of Bitfinex's role in this industry and their ongoing development of the platform, their place in the broader crypto market, their place in the stablecoin ecosystem via Tether and all of the enormous amount of liquidity that has brought to the market, not just over the course of the last few years, but especially in the last quarter. And generally speaking, just how Paolo is thinking about the international and domestic repercussions for their company and for the crypto industry in general. So there's a ton of ground that we could cover. Bitfinex is obviously one of the OG exchanges and arguably the top source of liquidity for Bitcoin, at least in the spot markets these days. Paolo, before we get into all that, why don't you walk us through the journey into crypto personally and how you came to Bitfinex and your role today in what is one of the most structurally important entities in the international ecosystem.
Thank you, Ryan. So my story, long story short, my formation, my background is in computer science and math. I started coding when I was really young, 8, 9 years old, and I did that since today, right? It's still today, I spend 90% of my time in coding. I graduated in university in Genoa and then worked for a few years as a researcher in the military telecommunication space. Then didn't pay much, so I decided to look into finance. I really love finance anyway. I I was looking around with, I was learning trading by myself. And then I said, well, I can really try to improve the traditional financial world where, you know, I worked with hedge funds, I worked with some Swiss banks, trying to improve their processes, trying to scale their processes. They were really, really outdated. That was around 2010, 2011. And then I decided to create a company doing exactly this in London. The company was called FinCluster and was born in 2012, 2013 to solve a scalability and create a common software for backend software, mainly for banks and hedge funds. Now, while I was doing that, it was in London, I was starting reading about Bitcoin, because my background is in my main background is in decentralized applications and scalable applications, parallel computing, and distributed systems, right? So I was reading about Bitcoin and say, wow, this is exactly what I like, but applied to finance. So for me, it was an obvious love at first sight. So started digging into it and started playing around with Bitcoin. I didn't contribute to the code base. I was just thinking and planning and trying to understand how Bitcoin could be used to build applications on top of it and to, let's say, trying to achieve a more resilient finance. So given my experience and not really good experience with, let's say, the traditional financial world with a really outdated protocol, you know, you had to send back and forth things via FTP or via, let's say, via FTP with the tabbed space files still in 2012, 2013. It was really an outdated technology. So for me, Bitcoin was a refreshing moment. While I was in London in 2014 and 2014, I met Giancarlo, the CFO of Bitfinex. You know, at that time, Bitfinex was probably the only exchange offering margin trading on Bitcoin. And that was quite cool. At the same time, they had some issues on the matching engine because it was slow. So everyone was really excited, especially after 2013. There was a big spike in Bitcoin price. I started discussing with Giancarlo, and basically we agreed that I should be involved in trying to improve the Bitfinex matching engine, given my background is in scalable applications, right? And then started doing that, and in a few months I was able to make it much faster, more or less between 100 and 1,000 hacks. The previous version was really not really best design, I would say. So so I step in, I was able to achieve that improvement. Then of course 2016 happened. I was at that time still a freelance. I had my startup, and then mid 2016 the hack happened, and basically I was asked if I could step in as a CTO and take care of overhauling the entire infrastructure, spinning up the new infrastructure, and continuing my role as both CTO and the developer of the matching engine. So I decided that was really definitely the best job that I could ever have. So I said yes, closed my startup in London, and move on to completely to Bitfinex. And since then, I would say we made giant leaps in scalability of the platform, and creating something that is really good for high frequency traders. 2017 became the end of 2017 became the CTO of Tether, and then kept doing this for till today.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain how your role has evolved between Tether and Bitfinex, and kind of where you currently sit, because there is some confusion over the organizational structures. We don't have to get into the banking and kind of creation and asset component of it, but where do you spend most of your time? Is it on the infrastructure? Is it on the Tether side? Or is this just a discrepancy that doesn't really exist in fact, it's more just a organizational chart issue?
So, you know, my experience, I have a really good expertise also in security. So that is one of the reasons why in 2016, I was asked to step in as a CTO of Bitfinex. My main role is to direct an amazing team of developers in Bitfinex and in Tether. Tether has less developers because most of the operations are on chain. Of course, we use well-known blockchain. So the key part of my role in Tether is ensuring that the blockchains that we are going to adopt has all the requirements that we want in terms of issuance, redemption, authorization processes. So that is what I do in Tether. And also I decide the processes in which these the issuances and redemption need to happen. So I'm really thorough and really annoying when it comes to security. Basically, I spent quite some time designing all these processes. In Bitfinex, instead, I spend I would say most of my time because I really code a lot there. I'm mainly involved in the matching engine and all and the backend processes. So I would say that I still the matching engine is still 90% me, also the core services is still 80% me, I would say.
Got it. So let's talk a little bit about Tether first, because it's just seen an absolute explosion in volume and in new creation, particularly over the last quarter. So there's two things that I think we should talk about. One is this transition that started, really people forget, only about a year ago, between OmniTether and then ERC and TRX Tether, which are, in Ethereum's case, Tether that's now traded, USDT that's now traded and held on the Ethereum blockchain is over 5 billion now, which is larger than USDT on Omni ever was. I think even at its peak, which is around 3 billion. This is a transition that really only happened last year. Can you talk a little bit about what ultimately led to the migration to Ethereum? It might sound like an obvious question and answer, but not only what led to that, but also the decision-making process for when to flip the switch. Because on the one hand, it's obvious there's a ton of developer activity, there's a ton of interest, and there's certainly the capabilities with ERC tokens to facilitate a type of transfer and creation like this. But on the other, Ethereum itself as a platform is certainly not ironclad from a security standpoint. And the last thing that you want to have happen is any issues with the fungibility of a dollar-denominated token during a chain split or a migration to a new chain, which is basically what Ethereum 2.0 is.
Yes. So first of all, the moment when we decided to create Tether on Ethereum was really, and few know that, was really end of 2017. If you recall, in end of 2017 we were almost at the peak of the bull run, and the prices of a Bitcoin transaction and hence Omni transactions at some point reached out to be $500. So of course there was, everyone was making money. So, people were kind of happy, but still they were really complaining hard about Tether. So we got a lot of complaints, and other exchanges complained that supported Tether, that is basically the majority, complained with us about the costs of running an Omni node, because ultimately you need to spend Bitcoin in order to send an Omni transaction. So in end of 2017, we worked on the Ethereum smart contract for Tether, and we deployed it. We really didn't use it, and we didn't. Beginning of 2018, the market started calming a bit, and by the time we were ready to to announce Tether Ethereum as an alternative, the fee cost went down quite a lot. So first of all, I want to say that we never intended to migrate. So we wanted to create diversity. We wanted to offer a way that a solution in case one blockchain gets bloated and not usable, not stable. We wanted to give another opportunity to use a different blockchain. So usually we suggest to exchanges to support at least two Tether blockchains. So at any point in time, traders can still move the funds between between one exchange to another. So and also Tether was born to make it easier, to make it faster, the cross exchange arbitrage. So if you have really high fees, or you have a blockchain that is bloated and the confirmation times are hours, then you lose completely the purpose of a stable coin. So that is why that is the key reason why we are on multiple blockchains. So we are on Tron, EOS, Liquid, and Algorand, for example. So basically, we started by then, and we then understood that traders would prefer anyway Ethereum just for transaction speed and costs in general. So costs are more predictable and usually lower on Ethereum. But the result of that is that all exchanges started to move to Ethereum, and then Ethereum kind of became, we basically bloated Ethereum, at least for a good part. So we decided then to continue our journey, and then we add Tron, and then Liquid. Liquid is, for example, a good example, gives a good diversity because you can have confidential transactions. So that is something that is, I believe, is quite interesting, because if you are a trader, you don't want to know, to have other people know when you are moving funds to an exchange. So that is give also an interesting edge. And Algorand is a pretty well known technology, so we decided to issue there as well, and EOS and also EOS. So basically, we are trying to capture all the different communities, the communities that we believe are most interesting among the different blockchains, and we try to serve them with the same stable coin. Because if we are present in all blockchains, then there is no need. We have at least enough first mover advantage, and we can lead the on every major blockchain.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that is a common source of criticism, or at least maybe concern in Western circles in particular, is the outsized market share of Tether versus some of the other stable coins. There's USDC now, there's Paxos, there's TrueUSD. Obviously, everybody's talking about Libra, and Binance now has their own synthetic dollar. There are a lot of these coming, and they're all living under different regulatory regimes and different structures. How do you think about Tether versus a fully decentralized synthetic like DAI, right, on the one hand, or a Western regulated asset like USDC, or one of the major ultimately central bank digital currencies or equivalent like a Libra, as you think about both today's competitive pressures or interplay, and then where things will be in 5 years from now?
So these are good questions. So first of all, I hope I'm going to say this right, because otherwise Stu, our general counsel, will slap me really hard. But basically, Tether is regulated in BVI and registered in FinCEN. So you can decide which jurisdiction you think that is best for a stable coin. but it's not that Tether is like far west, right? Is regulated and is registered in FinCEN. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, we are much bigger than the rest, and I believe that the reason for it is that we understood really well the use case of a stablecoin and crypto space. So, first of all, Tether was created in 2014. So, and by a group of people that really cared about this industry and really cared about trying to find ways to bring mass adoption to this industry. Because, you know, in 2014, at the peak of volatility, the spread between exchanges was 30%, 20%. So in order to reach mass adoption, you have to pass numerous steps. And one of these steps is to have healthy markets. So Tether got a really big first mover advantage. And the rest of the competition arrived in late 2018 when all the fun, at least from 2017, passed. So it is, first of all, it is to be noted that the competition really wasn't in this market and didn't contribute, at least in this market, as Tether did since the beginning. So, and till today, so after 2 years or 1 year and a half of existence, they are mainly on one single blockchain. And that is one of the other things that I really cannot believe why they are not adapting themselves. Because, of course, I really love Bitcoin, and for me, there is just basically Bitcoin. But also, I really don't like religion wars. So if there is a good, if a blockchain is secure, and if a blockchain has a good community, and good security standard give us the instruments that we need in order to perform issuance and redemption in a secure way, I believe that we need to serve that community. This is what is making Tether great. For example, Tron did a really good job in marketing and started converting a lot of Tether from Ethereum to Tron and from Ohm to Tron. So, and we couldn't have done that without supporting Tron. So, it's only logical that Tether is such bigger compared to competition, because we really trying to understand the market where we are in. We are not trying to create a stable coin just to have a pile of cash and make some interest out of it. Of course, it's a nice thing. Tether is a private health company, so we need to have a business model. At the same time, Tether was born for a purpose, that is helping the crypto industry. So this is a big differentiation between us and the competition. And sorry, I forgot the other questions.
I think we can move on. You pretty much covered it, and I know any answer that starts with "I want to make sure that I get this right," so that I don't get in trouble with the lawyers, is something that I don't want to trip you up with, because I recognize there's some sensitivity here. But maybe more in macro, I want to touch on that point tangentially. How have you found it managing communications with a global ecosystem of investors and stakeholders and users of the platform, when really there's implicit trust in Bitfinex as an exchange, implicit trust in Tether as an entity, but there is only so much you can do structurally to go, you know, open kimono, and you could, that's for a variety of reasons. One being regulatory and legal, another being just technical. So, you know, not wanting to divulge too much information that it would weaken your internal security systems. And this is not something that's necessarily unique to Bitfinex, but it's certainly top of mind, I'd imagine. And yet, Bitfinex is still the largest liquidity pool in many markets for spot, and has some of the deepest pocketed investors actively trading, making markets, and you know, even investing in the company. How do you think about building those relationships, building up that trust, when the default would be you go radically transparent, and that's really not an option in this market for a few different reasons?
So, first of all, we have an history of publicly we had always mixed feelings by the community. So we have been asked multiple times to be more transparent in the past, and I believe that since 1 year we made a much better job in trying to reach the community and grow the community and make sure that the community, both Bitfinex and Tether, and also the rest of the crypto community, understands really well what we are doing. So, for example, when we decided to launch Leo, the approach that we took is, okay, let's make sure that people can see exactly how it works. You can see the market, the orders placed on the market. There are in the trade blotter, you can see the trades. And you can see minute by minute burning. So it is a different approach. We decided that we should be really, really open as much. Of course, as you said, you cannot go full open kimono. But at the same time, we made a lot of steps in that direction. I believe that Bitfinex is and Tether, believe it or not, is made by only really people with high integrity. So of course, everyone here has a family, as parents, most of their child, a wife. You don't really know what. There is no reason in an industry that, luckily for us, because we got lucky to enter really early. You really don't. You don't need to do, malicious things. If you act as a respectful person and you act with integrity, you can really show that to your investors and to your community, and people will stick around. So we discovered that, and that was amazing. We saw that in 2016, and we have seen in 2019with Leo. So we are really humbled by that. But everyone that, usually with exchanges, it's really hard to talk with the top management. I kind of never sleep, because my contact, my Telegram is in the hands, and I know Giancarlo and many others in the management. Everyone has the contacts, so all the customers have our contacts, in order that if there is a problem, they can write to us, and we leave the ringtone high in order to get waken up by them, and we work directly the issue. So this is the way we are, we have a different approach. I really like our approach. It's more personal. It's direct. If we messed up, we say, okay, we messed up. That's it, right? We are proud of what we built, but also we recognize that sometimes you cannot always get everything right.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets, and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refund or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MessariTax and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with 2Ks tax.com and save money this tax season. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the crypto.com app today.
You know, one thing that I think, you know, would go a long way industry-wide to improving trust levels is something that Nick Carter has been very outspoken about, this concept of proof of reserves. So, you know, basically using some type of cryptographic proofs to, you know, zero knowledge or otherwise to, you know, kind of self-attest and self-report on some periodic basis that the entity actually has the private keys to certain addresses, and that equals X amount of dollars or you know, X amount of Tether or Bitcoin or what have you. And this would help, you know, really quickly with maybe not the largest exchanges. You know, that would certainly shore up confidence from an institutional clientele base. But if the largest exchanges took that example and were able to spearhead that initiative, then it would have a trickle-down effect where it becomes the industry standard, and you wouldn't have such acute risks for smaller exchanges that might be struggling to get by and starting to cut corners and facing the temptation to go fractional or even exit scam. You basically take that completely off the table and you can front run some of these issues. You know, when you talk to some executives, they'll give a hand-wavy answer. You are the CTO, so you'd be the one in the driver's seat for enacting something like this. Is that something that Bitfinex and Tether will consider somewhere down the line? Forget about legal and accounting audits, the raw cryptographic audits of assets under management. And you know, if it is something under consideration, what are the steps or challenges that would dictate whether that can be enacted?
So I really like this topic because for one specific reason. So in 2018, 2019, Bitfinex became a EOS block producer, although I seem to be diverging from your question. I'm not. So we had the entire EOS community asked us to prove that we were voting rightfully with the EOS funds on Bitfinex, and they asked us to prove that we were only voting with the assets that were owned by certain people, and they were willing to vote. So what I decided to build is a solution that is similar to the proof of reserves. I believe that is a step farther, because we were able to give a tool to our users that every day was recreating all the user balances in a Merkle tree. And then basically each user could download their a set of keys to vote, verify, basically to vote for their preferred block producers. But really the underlying thing of that solution was that when you vote, you have to verify that your balance is the correct balance that is inserted in the Merkle tree. So you are stating that balance exists on Bitfinex. The tricky part that also we were able to solve, and that is kind of more specific to Bitfinex or the margin trading exchange, is that, of course, we allow long and short, right? And we have a peer-to-peer lending market. So we were able to put that into account also in the Merkle tree. So I really love that solution. And I promised myself that we would use it also for proof of the reserves in the future for Bitcoin and so on. Of course, the amount of Bitcoin and the amount of the accounts that we have on the platform is really, really big. So do that efficiently for Bitcoin is hard, but we are definitely working in that direction. So we have the tool, we build that, and with certain threshold, like you removed all the DAS accounts and so on, and you can really do a nice, you can do some nice attestation and proof of reserves. So, well, this to be said that, I mean, we are trying to do some steps in that direction. It's something that we really do care of. Of course, then you have the banking part that is not easy to prove. You don't have a cryptographic proof of that. But all the cryptocurrencies should be simple enough to prove in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's simple, then what are the gating items?
Sorry?
If it's simple, then what are the gating items to just, you know, doing this and putting it on like transparency.tether or putting it on a transparency Bitfinex page?
Oh, well, Tether is just blockchain, right? So you don't need that because basically Tether doesn't hold, has just a small inventory used for as a buffer to process, query.
True. Yeah. I guess this would apply to on balance sheet Tether, right? So I'm not talking about total in circulation, I'm talking about on balance sheet Tether, Bitcoin, and the like, you know, if it's relatively simple to do, what would prevent you or any other exchange from being the first to kind of show these proofs via some transparency dashboard? So you could prove solvency on a periodic basis, whether that's monthly or quarterly or in real time.
No, of course. For the Tether side, you have basically our inventory. We have just a few Bitcoin because they are just needed for Omni fees, right? But the majority, so all the Tether that are in the authorized but not issued wallet, that is the treasury, are in our process. So we definitely we can publish a proof, but it's our proof of our word because we do a transaction every day from those wallets. So we definitely have keys. I believe that the tricky part is doing that for an exchange. So that is where I started because exchanges like Bitfinex, we have millions and millions of users. And we have, if we just do it for Bitcoin, we have three wallets. So we have tens of millions of Bitcoin wallets, basically. And that would mean generating a really big Merkle tree. And the code, by the way, that I mentioned before, is open source. So you can see that we took steps and we developed and we paid open source developers to help us designing something that could work to still keep the privacy of the users, of course. But what I liked of our solution is that if you put all our user base together, then they can all prove together that the sum of their funds, because the root of the Merkle tree is the total of the funds that that our balance sheet shows in Bitcoin, for example. And then all the nodes in the Merkle tree are representing the user balances. Of course, we are using different techniques similar to ring signatures in order to make it private. But the user can, if every user prove that their funds, their allocation is correct, then the sum needs to add up to what is in the root of the Merkle tree. And then the Bitcoin, we have only one Bitcoin hot wallet. Well, one Bitcoin hot wallet with some change addresses, of course. And but the majority is held in two different Bitcoin hot wallets, cold wallets. So the idea is that you can compare the number that you get on top of the Merkle tree with what we had in the cold wallets and the plus hot wallet. And then you can verify that we have all what we are supposed to have. So, by the way, this is exactly what we are doing every 10 seconds internally. You can see that despite all the other changes, we are moving towards that direction. The technology is called Antani. It's public at github.com/bitfinex.com/Antani. And you can see that. We have in our roadmap the idea of using it for different currencies. We just need to speed it up because right now it's quite slow. Probably we will rewrite in C++.
Makes sense. So another big question for most of the major exchanges now is this question of what is true volumes and true order book depth. And if you talk to any traders in the industry, they'll tell you, you know, they know liquidity when they see it, and you know, many have just developed deep relationships with the top most liquid exchanges over many years, and so there's I don't want to call it information asymmetry, but there's kind of anecdotal trust that builds up over time just from actually using the different platforms and executing major trades. On the other hand, you know, even for some of the most liquid exchanges, you know, Wobi, OKX, you know, some of the Korean exchanges, you look at their order books and they just don't add up, right? So there is some inflation of trading volume. And it's very difficult to calculate a VWAP. It's very difficult to give people a sense of you know, kind of snapshot liquidity in the system without higher fidelity trading volume data. What can you help explain some of the work that you do internally to suss out spoofing and, you know, other manipulative trading practices so that you can really hone in on what a true, fair, and liquid market is that won't just have disappearing orders once, you know, things actually move in wildly in one direction or the other? Because this is something that is, you know, I know for us personally at Messari, it's maddening as a data company to try to just chase your tail and you know, fight this uphill battle of getting data directly from exchanges, but having no real ability to audit where that data is coming from, and then just playing a cat and mouse game with data science to figure out what's real and what's just being spoofed.
So, I mean, you are really touching on a really sensitive topic for me, because I love this topic because Bitfinex takes good care of his books. We have few ground rules. We don't fake liquidity and we don't fake volume. We are willing to ensure that we are really interested in ensuring that our markets are clean from misleading behavior. So we started using a software called Iridium a few years ago that helped us in this process. And now today, with our experience, we were able to build our own internal software. We have plenty of tokens that don't trade anything on Bitfinex, just because we really don't want any weird activity. Sometimes we find tokens that that are trying to inflate the volume, and we promptly, when I say promptly, it says within 24 hours, reach out and say, okay, please stop. We don't want to see this in our exchange. It's fine to provide liquidity, but providing liquidity means creating a nice order book with a nice, that is like a full restaurant, but you don't have to match with yourself. You just need to provide a tight spread. That's it. So that is the key fact for me. And really, Bitfinex, first of all, I believe that has a really fair fit here. And that is one of the reasons why we have the best liquidity in class. If you give zero or, well, if you give 2 basis point taker fees, the cost of removing liquidity is basically almost zero. So you end up in having markets that will not have enough liquidity to resist big movements in volatility. So that is one of the things that usually traders and other exchange owners don't understand much, right? It's nice to have zero maker and zero taker, or zero and one, whatever, but that is not how it can work. The Bitcoin and crypto industry is still young, it's still small. You have 200 billion overall in all the markets, split among all the exchanges. And that is not enough to create a deep liquidity. And then if you give everyone a free ride where they can take liquidity out of the exchange, then basically all your books will be really thin as soon as the market moves 3%. So that is what we learned, and what we really don't care that when the price moves $1, $10 in 2 hours, we have like $50 million in volume. We really don't care that. We care that when the price moves, the volume goes up because our books are really thick. Just to give you an example, today, that is by coincidence, just before starting our call, our volume was really low, was like 30 million for the last 24 hours. And we were below most of the US exchanges for the Bitcoin USD price and most of the exchanges in general. The price moved really quickly in a few minutes, and the price of the volume of Bitfinex jumped almost twice the competition. So, and that is what I call real volume and real liquidity, because when the price doesn't move, there is no reason for the volumes to be crazy high. But when the price moves, then a lot of big orders get hit, and then you can have really high volume. So these are, I believe, really important key concepts. If I had to develop a metric, I would create a metric on the ratio between, let's say, volatility and volume and the volume difference.
I like that a lot. I'm curious. So is that metric available anywhere right now?
No, I just made it up. But I made it up. But it's what I would do, right? I think it makes sense because it's one of the things that we keep telling each other, and with the traders that praise Bitfinex for liquidity, they say as soon as the price move, there is no liquidity elsewhere. We come all to Bitfinex, right? And you can see, right, we were 30 million, and in a few minutes, we went to 110 million in trading volume, right? So that is the best feeling. And we are not doing analysis on other exchanges. We just focus on ours. But I believe that is one of the key metrics that I would like to see.
I like it. We're going to have to sidebar on that at the end of this conversation. Bitfinex has deep liquidity, has not made the decision yet to go as deep with listed assets. How do you think about adding assets? Is it purely on a liquidity basis? And is it a dollars and cents standpoint in terms of how much you can make in trading fees? Is there a first mover advantage? How do you make toe the line and strike this balance between listing literally everything, like you see with some of the other large exchanges, and having some quality control so you can cater to the larger traders and focus on liquidity instead of breadth of coverage?
So this is another interesting topic. So we listed quite a few of tokens, in the past, and most of these tokens are not making volume, and they are making maybe $1,000 per day in trading volume. We don't make money on them. Of course, recently, to improve the liquidity, we decided to delist a lot of redundant pairs and leave just one main pair for these tokens that don't trade much. Mm-hmm. I believe that from one point of view, it is important to therefore a big exchange to support even smaller tokens, because otherwise just become the token that raise more has all the open doors, right? So you have to give a fair chance to everyone. Of course, what we ask usually is to ensure that the community is onboarded and is basically joining Bitfinex and helping Bitfinex to have good liquidity. That is basically the main thing. We decided to open to more tokens in the past. Now we are narrowing down. We are a bit more careful. But in the past, we decided to follow this practice. If the token is has a good community and is a legitimate token, we do an analysis both on the smart contract and on the on the quality of the project, the activity on GitHub, and so on. Then we decide to list it. Of course, unfortunately, some tokens that we listed, I'm sure many exchanges have, don't have much more activity, so they lost a bit of traction. We really want to help the industry growing, and I believe that you cannot do that only listing the top 20, 30 tokens. You need to give a fair chance to everyone, as long as they respect the rules. Between these rules, you have also, we take really good steps in ensuring that we list a good quality tokens. I think that our compliance and legal team is really thorough in that. The more regulations are coming our way, in the sense that in general, our way towards the crypto industry, we are creating more and more strict rules just to ensure that we are always respecting the requirements of the regulators. So we believe that with the legal opinions, with ensuring that having a deep understanding of the management behind the project and so on is the right thing to do, because it's what really traditional finance does on an everyday basis when you have an IPO, for example.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we face this issue as a data company, even just, you know, where do you draw the line? You know, there are providers that literally have information on thousands of assets, and it's just kind of like the bulletin board approach. You know, for us, we prioritize the top, you know, 100, 150 to have full profiles and, you know, full understanding of the supply curves and token economics, things like that. But you start getting past that and you're talking about, you know, ecosystems that are sub Series A in size, right? If you're comparing it to the traditional market. So there's no money there. There's no interest. If an investor is going to make a decision to actually trade a token like that, and it's, you know, an investor with any level of sophistication, they're just going to do a block trade and it's going to be a private placement, right? And we've seen that with assets like Numerai is a good example. Took, you know, Paradigm and Placeholder, made a direct investment. I know Decred has taken direct investments. You know, some of the other larger assets have, you know, sold tokens from their balance sheet. Maker did the same thing. You know, far beyond that, it's just you're shooting yourself in the foot, because, you know, we don't know how many of these projects are ultimately going to be around long term. I think the dividing line has to be, do you think if there's 1,000 assets today and 90% of them are shit, that in 5 years there will be 10,000 assets and 9,000 of them will be shit? So you're still growing the addressable universe, but that doesn't necessarily change the fact that the long tail is going to be really muddy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are taking the steps of, many of these these tokens will anyway, the ones that are not active will basically just die out, and they will get delisted. We had many cases already. We are also taking strong steps against tokens that are not releasing the entire code base open source. So, for example, many started as ERC20, right? And then if one of the key things, at least for me, from a pure intellectual point of view, we all started this industry based on Bitcoin, that was open source white paper, open source technology. So I really don't want to support any token that is not open source. So we start to have more and more rules that eventually will bring us to the list more and more tokens that are not following these rules, because I really think that you have to be respectful of the you have to really be respectful of the nature of our industry and the openness of our industry. And we have listed now, I believe, 200 tokens, a bit less probably, and we will probably trim a bit in the future. So mm-hmm. we will start checking, for example, GitHub activity, liquidity, and all these things, and we will make decisions. So I don't want to end up in a situation where we have thousands and thousands of tokens. I want to be a situation where I still list small tokens, and that is fine for me, as long as there is a good interest and good reason behind it, just because we believe in their vision, or just because they don't come up with crazy valuation and then their valuation got minus 99% the year after, right? So I really like, there are a few projects that are approaching us and they have really reasonable valuation. Like, okay, I have a valuation of $500,000. In 2017, 2018, you got the minimum valuation was $50 million for the worst project ever, right? Then, so there is I start seeing project understanding that the times change, that there are things that cannot be done as in the past. And those are the tokens that I like.
Last question. We've talked a lot about metrics, as you can imagine, since Bitfinex is a wealth of information and the data that comes out. I don't want to make a direct endorsement of Bitfinex, but just in terms of the data and metrics that we look at and review on a regular basis. The data that we get from Bitfinex seems to be clean, much cleaner than you know, some of the other large exchanges. So I did want to ask about one more metric, and then maybe we'll end with my favorite new question. But the interest rate in the industry, like what is the LIBOR for crypto? You've heard people talk about it, and we had our own calculations thinking about how do you think about the perpetuals and the implied interest rates from perpetuals and other derivatives from CME and Bitfinex and now FTX and others, and then just what's the kind of risk-free margin rate on the major exchanges? Where is the funding rate right now for Bitfinex on an annualized basis? And then how do you think about quote unquote risk-free rates in this industry, or as close as we can get to it, since this is default and a risky industry to begin with, but we need to have some baseline to think about pricing risk assets as the lending market continues to explode.
So this is a really good topic. So first of all, Bitfinex offers peer-to-peer lending. So we don't determine the lending rate. We see a few exchanges that offer margin, but they act as banks, right? So first of all, again, this is one of the things that I don't like, just because from a developer point of view, I really love peer-to-peer systems. So for me, we all started with Bitcoin again, peer-to-peer is really a nice keyword that I try to apply to all the products that we give. So we see some project that give 6%, some exchanges that offer 6% annualized, I believe, from 6 to 13, and that applies both for borrowing and for margin trading. So if you, for example, short Bitcoin, how much you pay. So in Bitfinex is quite hard, really depends on the volatility of the, let's say, the previous period, because again, the lending rates, the lending market is an actual trading market. So you can borrow funds, and you can borrow funds at different rates, and the rate depends on what is available in the book, and usually the length of your need. We offer from 2 to 30 days. So we are around like 11% per year, 15% per year on the major coins. Really varies a lot. We have been a lending market and a peer-to-peer lending market. We, of course, when let's say there is a big raise in price, let's say $3,000, we can see that the number of longs in Bitcoin increased. So it means that people start borrowing more USD and or USDT. So if there is not enough liquidity for the momentum, we have a sudden spike in lending rates on Bitfinex. Then eventually they will adjust, because also if I borrow, I have the ability to return the fund early in order to pick maybe something that with a better rate. So when it comes to almost zero lending rates, I believe that is, I'm not sure if I like that. I'm not a big fan of it. I believe that the risk needs to be priced. It's not just the risk of position being stopped out or whatever. It's also the risk of keeping the funds on an exchange. So I'm a really honest guy. I'm not the type of person that say, oh, come on, keep everything on Bitfinex. Bitfinex offer the highest security levels. I really do take seriously every single line of code that could be pushed to production. I review everything, basically. But I really like people taking care of their own private keys, right? And this, so the fact that you are not taking your Bitcoin securely with your private keys, but you're keeping on an exchange, and you need to get some interest out of it. I believe that is fair. And also, I believe that you should be the person that decides which interest you should be. And you need to price your own risk and your reward.
I think, you know, we're going to be doing a whole lot more work on this. There's a ton that I think our team would love to work with Bitfinex on just to clean up some of the data standards as well. For final question though, I want to end with a fun one. The first time that I asked this question was with Chad Cascarilla from Paxos. And I asked him when the Bitcoin movie is ultimately made, or better yet, the HBO series, because we know that there's not going to be any movies made anytime soon in LA.
Yeah.
The HBO series, which actor is going to play Paolo?
I hope not the usual actor that is doing villains in movies. I prefer to be the good guy.
All right, so you don't want to get typecast, but who's the best actor to actually play one way or the other? Or maybe who's the villain? And if you're cast as the villain, who's the actor? And if you're cast as the good guy, who's the actor?
So let me think. That's a really nice question. So the nice actor, I would say DiCaprio. I really love him. In his latest films, also
you're gonna have to play a pretty dominant role in the next couple of years to keep raising that profile.
If you want minor actors, I really like the guy from Ozark. You see Ozark?
Jason Biggs.
I'm really bad with names, but
Jason Biggs. You know, it's hysterical. I've asked this question twice, and that was also Chad's answer. So everybody, everybody loves Jason Biggs. How about if you're the villain?
If I was the villain, then let me think. Well, not the villain, but also a more borderline character. So the actor that is playing Tyrion Lannister.
Excellent. I love that. That one's way outside of the box. So
because has the right. I mean, I like to make people laugh.
I think that's about as wide a spectrum as we're going to get for that answer, even if I ask it 100 more times, between Leo DiCaprio, Peter Dinklage, and then Jason Biggs. But in any event, look forward to doing this again soon. Congrats on all the progress this year with Tether and for the important continuing work and liquidity that Bitfinex is providing. We're looking forward to working with you guys on more data projects. And in the meantime, appreciate you hopping by for this episode of the podcast.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to everyone else that tuned in or watching on YouTube. Till next time, follow up on Twitter at 2BitIdiots and check us out, sorry.io. We will see you next week. Peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiots. If you want to continue the conversation or troll me, otherwise, I'll see you next week.